I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Daryl.
Hi, everybody. My name is Daryl, an anorexic and a compulsive overeater. Hi, everyone. I'm glad to be here, and I thank May for asking me, and I thank everybody for coming and, you know, basically making a meeting. Okay, the whole thing. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. That's basically, I know I have 35 minutes. Okay. I guess what I want to say, what it was like for me was pretty, I mean, the longer that I'm abstinent, I guess I want to say that I have been abstinent 15 years, October 13th, 1987, I got abstinent. And I've been abstinent ever since, which is, for me, eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner no matter what. And I have a couple snacks because that's the way my lifestyle is. And I come from the anorexic. I'm an anorexic, and I gained about 30 pounds. And I have to tell you, the disease for me, I thought that I was fat. The distortion, the exaggeration of the disease basically almost killed me. So it's a miracle that I stand before you with everything that's gone on in my life, the good, the bad, the everything, and I've been able to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner, of which the day before I got abstinent, I couldn't do it. So it's really an amazing gift, and my gift is to stay abstinent, to keep giving it back and giving it back and giving it back. And there's a line, it's easier to stay abstinent than it is to get abstinent, and I believe that. So my job is just that. And let me go back to what it was like. What it was like for me is that I come from a household where I was incested by both my mother and my father. I slept with my mother till I was like 16. Yes, I did. And so everything was kind of messed up. But I didn't know it was messed up. I just got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And I never knew that anything that happened in my life had anything to do with anything. I didn't know there was a cause and an effect. So I don't think I didn't deal with that. I'm dealing with that now, and I understand why I didn't deal with it then. And I'm grateful to food because it kept me alive to get this far. And it's amazing what the body can handle. I should have been dead. I've been in two hospitals. And part of my bottom was I didn't eat for 4 days, and I was at the gym for those 4 days. And I couldn't sit down after a meal. I had to walk. I had to do something to get it out. And I didn't know what I wanted to get out, but what I learned is I wanted to get out or get away from my feelings. And there's a line that I love so much, and it goes like this. When I came to Overeaters Anonymous, I felt better. I felt everything better. And it's true. You know, I have definitely experienced the wave of my great feelings and the ones that just have to come. So maybe a little bit more about what it was like. My parents divorced when I was 7. I used to sit on the bed when my dad would leave and just cry and think if I cried really hard and really loud, he would come back. I didn't get the concept of, I mean, he was so far away. He was like 2 miles. And I'm thinking if I just cry, he'll come back. Like the hole inside, that hole inside. And I'm a little vulnerable today because I'm kind of dealing with the incest stuff that I talked about. And so the fact that I was sitting at home thinking, what am I going to say? I don't know what to say. And the message is that this is going to pass. And it's all going to be okay. And it really is all okay now because I've lived through my past. And I survive. So really, anything else that comes along my way is can't be what it, you know. If I had to deal with starving, then if I don't starve, I can really go through anything. And I was taught early on that God will never give me more than I can handle. So these lines that I was taught in Overeaters Anonymous have really saved me. When I went off to college, the next event that stands out in my life is that my brother died of a heroin overdose, and he wasn't found for 5 days, and the gardener found him. My brother Stan, and I was 19, he was 27, and I remember thinking, why didn't he talk to me? Why didn't he come to me? It's like, now I know, I don't care who talked to me when I was starving, I wasn't going to listen to you. I had a mission, and I had a disease, and no one was going to stand in my way, and I didn't care who you were. And the magic happened when one compulsive reader helped me, when someone who I didn't even know talked to me. And that happened when I got here. And so Stan died. The day that my brother died, my dad gave me Valium, because I wasn't supposed to feel sad, I guess. Or he needed Valium, so he gave it to me, and he took some too, you know. And so I didn't deal with that. And how my family dealt with feelings was, we shut them off. So as a result, as I'm growing today, I have a really hard time still letting myself just kind of sit still and feel. The day after the funeral, and I was leaving to go back to college, my dad looked at me, and I was hugging my mom goodbye, and I was crying, and he said, "You've got to stop crying, go on with your life." And that's what I thought I had to do, because I didn't have any other information. When I got here, I got different information, the kind that like has assisted me in spiritual growth and survival and living. So I've done a lot of work, and that was about the emotional stuff. And the food for me started when I was in high school. I just remember sitting in a chair like these, and my thighs looked big. And I thought, oh my God, I'm getting fat. And thighs get wider when one is sitting in a chair. And I didn't, that concept was beyond me. I think all concepts were beyond me. I think my growth was stunted really early on. And so my starving started there, went off to college. Before my brother died, I was being sexually harassed by a tennis coach I had. I had been sexually harassed by a man I worked with. Like, I kind of went to anybody who would pay attention to me at whatever cost it took. And I had no boundaries. So I went into my life and had no boundaries. But here I've learned so much, and I want to talk a lot about what I have learned and how my life has changed, because I really wanted to die. And when I went into the first hospital and the doctor looked at me and he said, "Well, your dad divorced, your mom divorced, your brother died, and your boyfriend moved." I'm like, "Uh-huh. So what's your point?" Like, I didn't get, like, there might be an abandonment. I didn't get what's abandoned. I didn't get anything, because I still wanted, I was in that hospital waking up at 2 o'clock morning, 2:30, 3, doing crunches, doing sit-ups on the floor. And they'd come in and they'd flash the light. I mean, I'm in a psych ward, okay? I'm not in a hotel, and I'm just stretching, and they knew every anorexic, bulimic game, and I just really thought they believed that I was stretching. And it didn't stop me. Now, they caught me, but it didn't stop me, because nothing was going to stop me, because the disease is that powerful. And one of the bottoms that I hit was, I remember laying in I used to pretend like I was sick a lot so I could stay home and be in my mother's bed. Now, it might sound a little odd. My mom put a deadbolt lock on our bedroom door so I couldn't come in. It's very awful. So I copied the key, and when I was sick, I'd go in there, and when she'd come home, I'd lock it up and do everything. And so I went to any lengths to just get this illusion of closeness. I mean, my life was an illusion. My life was distorted, and that's what the disease did. And in that distortion, again, I just want to say that it kept me alive, and that I'm here today because of it, and I'm very grateful. But I remember sitting on the phone with my grandma, who was alive then, and her saying, "Mama, Mama, you got to get better." So I said, "Mama, Mama, I'm going to do it, Granny. I'm going to do it. I'm going to eat. I'm going to get better." The next day I did the same thing. I'd get up and I'd starve. I'd get up and I'd go in the bathroom and I'd jog naked, and then I'd get on the scale, and then I'd walk over here and then I'd get on the scale, and then I'd go over here and then I'd get on the scale, and I was powerless and I didn't know. And when I went into the second hospital, they had just like this 12 steps and 12 traditions on a scroll on the wall. And I read the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, food, that my life had become unmanageable. I thought, powerlessness, that's so stupid. I have so much power. Look at me. It's so stupid. And again, I believed that. And my anger, I was so rageful. I was so angry, and so angry at my mother. And so I blamed my mom because my brother was found in the backyard and my mother never looked. So I blamed her. And again, there's no blame. There is no, she didn't make him do that. No one made me starve. It's just that's how I coped. So I got down to 97 pounds and I went into this hospital, and they used to have a circle. They used to have 3 hours. We used to have 3 hours. I think an hour of individual, an hour with the family, then another hour with, they bring panels in. And when they'd have the panels, the circle would be here, and I would be in the circle. I'd have these sweats on, and I'd have my socks off, and I'd look the other way because I wanted no part. And the gift is, I got Will anyhow. And it's like, I don't have to like it here. I just have to get here. And then what I've learned is I just have to stay here once I get here. And the magic happens. So I am someone who was as defiant and angry and not wanting Overeaters Anonymous, but at the group, they had us go to one meeting a week, and there was an anorexic bulimic meeting at the federal building that's not there anymore. It was on the 17th floor. I took my dad because I thought if he understood, I would get it. And he's also a compulsive overeater, and he got us out of there faster than I did. I never got any newcomer packet. You know, he just got us out because he couldn't deal. And, but the one thing I remember from that meeting is the speaker shared, I don't remember what she really said, but she talked about in her life like that she had lied. She lied. And I used to lie all the time. I used to say, I'm here on Saturday night, I'm going out with my friends, and I was in bed. What it got to was, I didn't answer the phone, I didn't call people back, I didn't answer the door, I didn't go out, I went to bed at 7, and that's what my life was. That's exactly what my life was. And I thought I didn't think there was any hope. And when I got to my first, I don't know what the first meeting really did, but there was a list of names, and they'd always ask about a sponsor, and I'd say no, and I have to tell this very sweet story. I didn't understand the language, you know, get a sponsor, what are some other things? Let us love you too, you can love yourself. There's some strange sayings if someone comes from the outside world and doesn't know what this is about. And they said, find a sponsor. So I asked my stepmother to be my sponsor. She wasn't in the program. She didn't even know about the program. Then I asked my boss. And she didn't want to be my sponsor. So sooner or later, something clicked. And I asked this woman. I got her name off the phone list at that time. And I picked up, I wrote down her name, Lisa. She had 5 years. I didn't know her at all. I called her. She talked to me for a little bit. She called me, and then I called her again. She said, you can call me again. You can call me tomorrow. Call me tomorrow. And I kept calling her. She kept wanting to talk to me. She kept wanting to do what I wanted my mother to do my whole life. And because I didn't want to lose that love, because I thought it was conditional. I didn't know that it's for fun and for free here. I didn't know that I'm of service to stay absent, but to be loving, to... It's a loving program, and it's a program to to just give back. And she was just doing her job. She was doing her 12-step work. And I was the recipient. And I asked her to sponsor me on her machine because I was too afraid to ask her in person. And she called me right back and said, yeah, what do you eat? And again, I wasn't eating much. And I was eating chicken broth and Weight Watchers yogurt for dinner at that time. And some of my, I guess I want to backtrack really fast and say, when I was at home, when my brother died, I quit school, I quit playing tennis. It was when my brother died, I actually got away from the tennis coach who was sexually harassing me because it was an excuse. So I didn't have to deal with him anymore. And so I came, I moved home, and my resentment and my anger towards my mother grew and grew and grew and grew and grew and grew. And what happened was that my mother had an apartment building on Shenandoah, Robertson and Pico, basically, and she had an apartment open, and she said, live in there, live there. And when I left my mother's house, I got abstinent. And the process of getting abstinent was the most frightening thing. I mean, I was 25, 30 pounds less than I am now, so my body had to change. And my miracle happened in that I just did what my sponsor said because I was afraid I would lose her love. I was afraid I would lose her attention, so my fear kept me abstinent. And it kept me, it just kept me alive. And soon she guided me through the steps, and my first step was just, she would tell me, eat this and call me back. And again, I come from not knowing what a portion was. So my rage that I had towards my mom, I didn't plan on eating like chicken broth with Weight Watchers yogurt. I mean, it just happened. The progression happened over time, the progressiveness of the disease. And, you know, it was Top Ramen, and Top Ramen comes with noodles. And when I lived at my mom's house, my rage was so huge that I would take the Top Ramen noodles, wait for her to come in the kitchen so she could watch me take the Top Ramen noodles out and shove them down the garbage disposal so she would be mad, so she would hurt. And what I learned from one of the meetings that I went to in Hawaii, actually, an AA meeting in the morning, I think it was the Seven Coconuts. And, it's great. I think 7 o'clock on Sunday mornings. And the speaker talked about resentment as me drinking poison expecting you to die. And that was my life story. And what I can tell you as my life story is progressing today and I'm abstinent, is my same fucking, excuse me, story. It is, my rage is coming up again and I don't do well with it. But what I learned in the beginning was when I had this, I ended up, I got into therapy, and for me, therapy and abstinence has really helped me. But I got to do an inventory, and my sponsor at the time, EG, because my first sponsor, she moved, and EG was, she had this raspy voice. EG's really great, and she intimidated me. She was short, and she had this, she was a musician, and I thought, who is this person? And so, she was very loving, and later on, after I judged her, like a few months later, I asked her to sponsor me. And that's usually what happens. So EG said about the 4-step, because she took me through the 4-step. She said, you have a month to do it, and it's kind of like, Daryl, think about it. It's like this chalkboard. There's all these white specks on the chalkboard, and when you do this inventory, all the white specks are going to fall down, and you're going to have this clean slate. You're going to have this clean chalkboard to deal with. And it was great. And she gave me a month, and I wrote down my 106 resentments towards my mother and towards my father, towards, you know, my... anybody who breathed, who took a breath, I resented, really. And is what I struggle with today. How can I accept somebody's limitations or disappointments or someone having a different point of view? I still have a hard time with that one. So I did this inventory, and then we sat in her trunk. We didn't sit in her trunk. No, we didn't sit in her trunk. We were small. We probably could have fit, but we didn't sit in her trunk. We sat in her truck. I sat in the front seat of her truck, and I read her this inventory, and I couldn't find my sexual inventory. We read everything, and I couldn't find it. And I'm thinking, oh my God, did it blow out the window on Mel? Is it someplace on Melrose Boulevard right now? Oh my God. I mean, I really could not find my inventory. And so she looked at me, and she says, just tell me. So the sexual stuff, I literally had to, I looked straight ahead, she was here, and I told her everything. And then I ended up finding it, it was stuck in my trunk. But I told her all that stuff, and my process had begun. And one of the things that was very helpful was we went to a meeting after. I was always taught to go to a meeting. I went to a meeting a day. I still go to lots of meetings. My sponsor taught me to call her, call somebody else, get to a meeting and stay abstinent, and everything else was a bonus, honey. That's what she would say. Everything else is a bonus. And if you sleep all day and stay abstinent, that's okay. And so I got my message. That was my message. And it doesn't always look good with me. And that's the honest to God truth. But I'm alive. And I'm not in the grips of this disease that kills. And so as my path continued, I've had many different sponsors. And I got another sponsor, did another inventory. And that's where I learned a lot of my part. What came out of my part with my, you know, I never wanted to have a part. I still, it's not, my first thought is, why did she do that to me? Or what? That's her. Like, I never think of me first. And the gift is, I know I've got to come back to me to get relief. Because I don't get relief. I can blame for a couple days, and then I'm, like, more miserable and more miserable and more miserable. So I learned, you know, manipulation, controlling, impatient, intolerant. In my second inventory, I learned about that I was silent and withholding. Like, I got so mad, like, at my mom, all those resentments. I never told her one day how I really felt. I just broke phones and smashed cakes and broke pictures and this anorexic rage that I had. I just did that, and I didn't know how to deal. So, and in my life today with the sponsor I have now, what I've learned with the last inventory I did, and I did the inventory on the abuse, the sexual abuse with my mother and my father, that I coped. The way I coped was I distanced, because I had to survive. I had to. The things that I did, I'd use to just keep living. And what I know now is I don't need to be distance or to withdraw to live, to be okay with people, but I a lot of times fall right back into it. What happened in my path is that I got in a relationship with a woman who I'm still together with now. It's 8.5 years later, and it's so difficult because there's someone else who has feelings, and I'm so self-involved. I am a really difficult person to remember there's another one in the room. And the disease, when I was really sick and ill, it was, again, it was all about me and my body and my weight and my stomach and my me. You know, it's that thing, me, to the tune of I, or something like that. Like, all about Daryl. And the thing about the process of absence that I get amazed about, and of working through the steps, is that I have changed. I might be self-involved, but I think of others. Like, the process of being loving, I was not loving. I didn't think of anybody else. But the staying here and the working through the program and the 10th step and all the different things have made me a different person. And I am forever grateful. The last thing I just want to say is my mom, this is actually the second thing, my mom died March 16th, it'll be 3 years ago. And this is the month that my grandma died when I turned 5. And so this month, my mom died. It's my brother's birthday who died, my grandma's birthday who died, and my mother's birthday that died. So it's really charged. It's really charged for me. And I somehow forget when I'm feeling awful in February that it's, you know, like, that's just what happens. But my sponsor turned 25 years absent today. And she said, and she's like my mom. I mean, God put this woman in my life who's just another loving person who says I'm her daughter and just really just loves me. And she said, all these things happen, but you've got a mom here who has a happy occasion, you know, who has 25 years. That's a huge thing. And she started with a day, and that's the only way to get a day is to get a day. To get another day is to just get another day. So there's no magic and there's no quick fix. The only way to get 15 years is to stick around 15 years and do the same thing that I did the day before, and it just accumulates. So I pray to have a lot of days. And when my mom died, the rage that I had towards her was, you know, I shared about it. And I made amends to my mom for, you know, she was diabetic, and I always hated her for being diabetic because she wasn't like the other mom. She couldn't do everything that the other mothers could do. And she, I mean, I learned to go to bed at 7 from her. I learned to not have any friends from her. I hated her for breathing, for everything. And I made my amends to her when I had, you know, 7, 8 months, 9 months, but not until, you know, I was 12, I guess, when she was dying, was that the amends really kind of flourished almost, and I was really able to just love her. And my best times with my mom, I have to say, it wasn't easy when she was alive. My best time was when she was in a coma. Now, that might sound, since that happened, my father and my sister and I, we've all kind of gone separate ways. I don't speak to my dad or my sister, and my dad's kind of said, when I'm sick and I get to the, I'm in the hospital or I'm at my funeral, don't come to my funeral, don't do any, you know, you're done, I'm done with you. So Overeaters Anonymous is my family, and it gets really lonely sometimes because I lose, although when I had my family, it wasn't, you know, then I'd have to go to the functions and all that kind of stuff. And but what I guess I want to say is, there's a line in the Big Book that I really love, and it talks about, let each family play together or separately as much as their circumstances warrant. God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And for me, my freedom comes from distancing, from distance. I mean, this is God's will, and it's really sad and all, but it's also for my best interest and probably my father's. Who knows how I would be acting with him? Who knows? Thank God I have a program, you know. So anyways, that's pretty much my story, and I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to have a life and to have just said that line of God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free, because I forget. I work really hard, and I want to figure everything out, and I forget to enjoy, to just enjoy. So anyway, thanks for my absence. Thanks for the 12-step call. Thank you. So do I just ask if there's any questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any questions? Yeah. Hi, Carrie.
If, you know, in your 9 steps, you come across amends for, you know, gossip or bad mouth, so what was, other than living amends, did you make any actual amends?
That's a great question. So the amends of gossiping, did I have to make amends for gossiping? And if so, besides living amends, what did I do? Character assassination is the easiest. You know, everybody does it. I don't go into the lunchroom at work because it's dangerous. You know, I sit in my office, and I have my detention for my students, and I talk with them because I am dangerous. And when I'm bored, I talk about you, and it's just the truth. So it's not pretty, but it is true. Really, the truth, the thing about amends for me, I think really it is I've made a more living amends than that one. And my living amends is really to not go into the situation, is to remove myself totally. Because for me, I would really say, you know, I really talked about you, but I didn't, you know, it's a tough one. But I appreciate the question, but I really think most of mine are living amends in that one. Stan.
Yeah, Daryl, thanks for coming out. I'm always grateful for your anorexic recovery. Can you tell me what you were eating the day before you got abstinent, then what you ate the day you got abstinent, and how did you get through that day?
Yeah, great question. You want me to repeat that question? Okay. What was I eating the day before I got abstinent, and what was I eating the day that I got abstinent, and how did I get through that day? Okay. This is my story. When I got this sponsor, Lisa, I had 32 days. Now, I had 30. I said when I got her, do I have to start again? She said no. Now, my day, I would share. There was a meeting Saturday afternoons. I don't know if you remember this, Leslie, but there's Saturday afternoons at the hospital, 4 o'clock on a Saturday in hospital on Roberts on Pico and Beverly Drive. There was a meeting, and they asked me to speak, and I had 30 days, and I can tell you, I had no sponsor. I had not much recovery. I don't think I talked anything about Overeaters Anonymous. And so my abstinence really didn't start then, but I had 30 days. Now, what I picked the, I said I had, and I think I did something for 30 days. And then I called her at 32 days, and at that point what I was doing was I was having the chicken broth, the Weight Watchers, yogurt. Maybe this time I was only having the chicken broth. And I think I was having a bran muffin and bran cereal in the morning, and what my sponsor said was, no more bran, no more bran, because I did anything I could to just, like, and so that day I talked to her, and it was around dinner time, and she said, okay, if you want the chicken broth, have that, just have, or if you want the yogurt, have something else with it, honey, have something else with it. So my first day, night of absence, the gift is I was taught, you can start where you're at, Daryl. Like, I didn't have to go back to whatever, start where I'm at. So I started dinner that night, and that was, I said, I have 30 days. She says, keep that. So then what happened the next day was, call me in the morning. And I don't know, I can't really remember the exact meal that I had, but everything that I did, she told me what to do and to call her back. She taught me how to have butter again. How to have potato, put the pat of butter on the baked potato and call me back. Go to the restaurant and call me. Look at the menu, see what they have and call me. What sounds good? So many things sounded good. So how I got through was, I just did whatever she said and I called her back. I didn't tell her what I was eating and call her after. Because that, I believe that for me is doing what I was doing before and just telling somebody. I really believe the first step for me is being willing to listen to somebody else. And what made me ready? I wish I could give a magic answer. I wish I could give the one line. Because, you know, I want you to have that line. I want to know that so I could tell you. But I don't know what that is. But I do believe that it's that God works while I'm talking now. Like, things are happening outside the room that are going to help save my life later on. Or, you know, so that's... Any other questions? Yeah, Jack.
You said the joint thing is one of the things you work on.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other things that you do that are challenging to you that you still have to work on?
Staying up past... Oh, should I read the question? I mean, like, say the question?
Yeah.
Okay. What are the things that I work on that are hard for me? And what are the things that I still work on? In addition to enjoying things, staying up past 7 o'clock. Now, it might be odd, but this is a huge accomplishment. Now, this meeting, the gift about meetings when I was new, we had a Monday night meeting that was at 8:45 till 10:15 at night. I had no life, so I could go. Like, I had no job. I had nothing. So it was the highlight, and it was great. It was packed, and it was just women just and men just wanting to get better. So meetings keep me up. Like, this has the ability to keep me up till 6:30, so I'm already ahead, you know. meetings were like at 8. We used to have dinner and then go to a meeting and go to bed. They used to be most of an hour and a half. But so anyhow, staying up, I have a partner, Beverly, and as I go through my stuff, my escape is to sleep. I learned it, and I perfected it. And so for me to go out to do anything, that's one of the things I really work on, is to just stay up and to answer the phone. I mean, I don't have a problem now with answering the phone like I did before. Some of the other things that I work on that are... not, I work on, I'm working on today in my life, like today, like an hour ago, is not withdrawing into my isolated shell because I get disappointed or I don't hear what I want to hear. Just that, just not with retreating, not retreating into myself, because the world is not about, it's out there. I mean, it's here, it's right now, but it's not just inside me, and I get scared and I withdraw. So I'm working a lot on those character defects, actually. And, you know, sometimes I think it'd be easier alone, but then I'd have another problem. And I deal with it alone. You know, alone is easy. It's together that's the more difficult for me. So anyhow, thanks. Yes, Lori. Oh, good. That'll take time. Yeah, ask me another one later. Okay, after. Let me try. Okay. So, what did I do in separating with my family? How did I do it and how did I get through it? And deal with the feelings of if I was guilty. Yeah, I shared that when my mother got me an apartment in her building, I got well, so I had to stay away. Now, I didn't work, you know, so they were paying for my food. My mom was paying for everything. The one thing I just want to share that I didn't share was I did have some money from a bat mitzvah. I mean, I had some money in my bank account from certain things. My grandma would put money in, and I was delivering pizza from a restaurant, and then I was delivering food from a basket in this restaurant. During the day, I'd go to places, and I'd go from store to store, and when they stopped buying the food, I thought it was my fault. And the people that I worked for were like family to me, and I was afraid to go and tell them that I didn't sell their food. So what I did was I would make all the sandwiches in the morning, go to a few places, drive by a dumpster, throw all the food in a dumpster, go to my backyard, sunbathe naked, get really tan, and then go to the bank and withdraw money and say daily and say, this is how much I sold. All the food's gone. Or I'd save a few. So I had no concept of money, but they were putting all the money in. So, but what I learned, my sponsor helped me with this one, actually. And she had me, I was so rageful, so much rage come up. She had me write my mom and dad a letter. They were divorced, so I wrote them separate letters, just telling them that I cared about them, but that I needed to take some time for me. And yes, I felt guilty because I was still taking money. And yes, I felt guilty because it wasn't the society thing to do. Getting absent and the actions that it takes to stay absent is not society's way of doing things, I think. It's counterculture, almost. It makes me a citizen, a one in the world, but it's like, it's intense. It didn't look like me taking care of myself. I had to live with the consequences, but what I did was I wrote them a letter and I told them that I love them and that I needed space. And they gave me that. I didn't go to my dad's house for a year and a half. I didn't see my mom for like 10 months. And the only thing I know is I got support from people in the program who just really taught me everything. Again, my mom went to bed, so I didn't. What I learned, too, as I've been absent, is I didn't learn a lot at home. I learned what I taught myself. And I learned from neighbors, from teachers. Teachers used to take me out to dinner. You know, babysitters, friends, moms used to buy me things because they'd see me go home to what I went home to. So that's what I did, and it's like abstinence. It's scarier in the hell in the beginning, but then that becomes a normal way of life. Then that's the comfortable thing. So the beginning's always hard of it, like a new job. I don't ever want to be new again. Anything new is really hard, but it becomes, as time passes, it's not new anymore, and it's the normal. It becomes normal. And then I was able to go back, and again, I loved my mom at the end. can't tell you what's going to happen with my dad because I'm not there. But, so that's...
With all the fear that you've had in you, how were you able to find an attachment, keep it, and keep that relationship?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How have I done that? Rope. I tie her up. Okay, so how have I been able to maintain my relationship basically with all the fear that I have? Not very well. I want to be hopeful. The gift is she's sober. She's sober 19 and a half years. So I've been taught here to just not leave before the miracle happens. So we do a lot of work. It's a great question because when I distance, I can just give you, let me just tell the truth here. Yesterday we were sitting at home and she said, "What am I doing here? You don't touch me. You don't hug me. It's like we're roommates." And I have to ask myself, what am I doing here? So I know that's not very hopeful right now. So let me get to today. Okay, hope, experience. I heard this thing, if you don't have the experience, don't give me your strength and hope. You know, that was good too. But my hope is that today, it's, I don't know, like me talking and opening up, and because of my incest that I'm going through, it's like a monster holding me back. And unfortunately, the people next to me get it. I mean, that's the truth. And she knows what I'm going through. It's my inability to just go and get the help. So I just don't leave. I think that that's it, and I trust that it's going to get better. It's like abstinence again. If I just don't leave, it's got to get better. People don't stay around here because it's bad. You know, it's who would do it if it was painful all the time? I mean, I have the best life besides everything I've just shared. just to not leave. Been so hopeful tonight, huh? One quickie. Okay. She's my sponsee. I had her come. God. Great question. We'll talk tomorrow. God. Yeah, that's a great question, trust. Again, my trust barometer was shot with my parents. The nitty-gritty is my dad did things, and my mom used to play with her breasts forever. And being the kid, the parents must have set the boundary, and she didn't. So my trust was just all over the place, and I trusted throughout my life the wrong people. And so when God puts the right people, I have a lot of loving people in my life, the first response I have is to not trust. It's like my first natural. It's like the first thing I think about is, oh, I'm fat. When I'm scared, oh, I feel fat. Not, oh, I'm scared about that. So my first response is that, and then I work on it, and my sponsor's really great. She has the ability to, when we talk on the phone, she sponsored me for 8 years now, and she's really a wonderful woman, and she knows me so well. And I have the gift of, I love that I know you so well. And I'm really blessed with that. And so on the phone, she can actually, not even seeing me, she's two lines that have always helped me. One is when I call her and I'm crying, she'll say, "This is great that you're crying. Maybe one day you'll be able to do it in front of me." Because I'm so afraid of that. And the other thing is I always want to get off the phone like, "Oh, okay, okay. Do you have some place to go?" And I'm like, no. She says, "Well, can't we just have a conversation? Jeez, I got you live. You know, can't we just have a conversation?" And I just, oh. So she kind of brings me back. But again, trust. There might be someone else who has a better experience than I do with that. But I just don't leave. And I trust that it will get better. So, all right. Great.